it for the show. If you'd like to sign up for our Daily Digest email list, get our headlines every day and news alerts, just text the word Democracy Now without a space, Democracy Now, to 66866. And you can get behind the scenes updates and stories from Democracy Now on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and more. Democracy Now produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis, Dana Sam Alcoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masu, Trina Dura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Coonerin's Electric Finban, Thursday, August 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Owl Social Club in Portland. Coonerin's Electric Finban and 1939 Ensemble perform Thai psychedelia and are part of the Pickathon-sponsored White Owl Social Club's outdoor summer concert series. Again, that's the Coonerin's Electric Finban and 1939 Ensemble on Thursday, August 10th at 8 p.m. at White Owl Social Club, 1305 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual Pan-African Festival of Oregon on Saturday, August 12th at Pioneer Courthouse Square, Portland. The first Pan-African Festival features entertainment, African food and clothing, informational booths, panel discussion, and more. The goal beyond that is to celebrate and illuminate the hidden treasures of the Pan-African community in Portland. Again, that's the first annual Pan-African Festival of Oregon on Saturday, August 12th at Pioneer Courthouse Square at Southwest Yamhill Street between Broadway and 6th in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there was another violent political confrontation in Portland yesterday. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman was there to bring us a report.
An air quality alert is in effect for our region until 7 o'clock tomorrow.
And Australia's parliament today blocked efforts to have a legislative vote on whether to extend marriage rights to same-sex couples.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 7th, 2017. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Motti. Yesterday, we saw another violent political confrontation in Portland. It's at least the fourth such event since late May, when two men were murdered by a man on a MAX train when they tried to prevent him yelling anti-Muslim slurs at two young women. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman was on the scene and has this report.
In Waterfront Park yesterday, right-wing ralliers and left-wing counter-protesters squared off yet again. The group Patriot Prayer, organized by Vancouver resident Joey Gibson, had its name on the rally in March, but a variety of right-wing agitators showed up, including Three Percenters and Oath Keepers providing security, a few straight-up neo-Nazis, members of the right supremacist group Identity Europa, and a small contingent somewhat inexplicably holding a Ron Paul 2008 banner. There was also perhaps a dozen Proud Boys, a self-described Western chauvinist cross between a paramilitary group and the Boy Scouts, identifiable by their uniform of gold-trimmed black polos and Make America Great Again hats. At the height of the march, there were as many as 150 people with the right-wingers. They faced off against at least 75 black-clad anti-fascists and 100 or so other counter-protesters. Prior to the rally, there was talk in the media from the rally's organizer Joey Gibson and from the group Rose City Antifa, short for anti-fascists, that this would be a chance to showcase more non-violent approaches to their ideological confrontation. It's unclear if those efforts were simply not enough or were blown out of proportion to begin with. But yesterday's event saw more violence between the two sides than at any other event this summer. That includes the large June 4th rally in Terry Schrunk Plaza, during which riot police cleared anti-fascist protesters from Chapman Square using rubber bullets and other weapons. Yesterday, there was only one cop, Sergeant France Schoening, who stood off to the side as the march repeatedly descended into melee fighting and bursts of pepper spray from one side or the other. The right-wing, camo-clad security people all had pepper spray strapped to their outfits, though I did at one point see somebody on the Antifa side spray a right-winger point-blank in the face during an argument. Either way, pepper spray, none of it deployed by police, found its way into the eyes, noses, and throats of dozens of people, including right-wing security, masked anti-fascists, an ACLU observer, and this poor guy who can be heard getting attention from Antifa medics.
Did you get pepper spray in your throat?
Again, I needed actually more water as well.
You wanted to drink a little of that?
Thank you.
That music you hear, by the way, is the unprecedented brass band, which kept up a steady, surreal soundtrack as the sides dueled along the waterfront. The band was there as part of a much smaller rally organized by Portland Stands United Against Hate. According to a press release today, their gathering was swept aside as soon as the right-wingers began marching down the waterfront. After a series of fights, the march swung back to the fountain at NATO and Salmon, where families with children still frolicked in the water. After more spirited back and forth in the shade, the march moved across NATO toward Chapman and Lounsdale Squares. This is when people began noticing riot cops hanging back from the action on 2nd Avenue.
Riot cops are out the corner.
Altercations were more political than physical in Lounsdale Square, consisting mostly of dueling chants and largely successful efforts by Antifa to drown out Joey Gibson with drums and air horns. Crossing to Chapman Square, Gibson gave a speech invoking the example of Jesus Christ and led the march back down to the waterfront. By the way, that chant of "Go Home Nazis" was directed at both sides by each other. In all, both sides, and for that matter the police, will probably claim yesterday as at least a propaganda victory. Antifa made the rally and march mostly inaudible and unapproachable, and the ralliers got to claim that they stood up to the violent suppression of free speech and patriotism. The police stayed almost completely away from the whole event, though they moved in after I had left the area as the event wound down and arrested three people, including two counter-protesters who are still detained and one of the right-wingers who was released because of an injury that required medical attention. For KABU Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the Southwest Clean Air Agency, and the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency have issued an air quality alert that's in effect until 7 p.m. tomorrow. Wildfires burning in the region, combined with forecasted conditions, will cause air quality to reach unhealthy levels due to smoke and ozone at times throughout Tuesday evening. Pollutants and smoke can cause burning eyes, runny nose, aggravate heart and lung disease, and aggravate other serious health problems. Limit outdoor activities and keep children indoors if it's too smoky. Please follow medical advice if you have a heart or lung condition. More information about air quality can be found at SWCleanAir, all one word, SWCleanAir.org, Oregon.gov/DEQ, and LRAPA.org.
Last week, the Portland City Council voted unanimously to spend up to $500 million to construct a water filtration plant to treat Portland's water supply. The council was forced to act after cryptosporidium was found in the Bull Run water that makes up the vast majority of Portland's water supply. Cryptosporidium, called crypto for short, is a microscopic parasite found in animal feces. Numerous tests from Portland's Bull Run water supply this year were found to be positive for the parasite. The positive tests violated federal EPA drinking water standards, forcing the council to act. The council also considered building an ultraviolet system that would have only cost $100 million, but opted for the more expensive filtration system since it would also remove other contaminants. The new water filtration system is expected to raise the average customer's water bill by up to $18 per month. The city council will spend the next 60 days developing a plan for the construction of the plant. It is expected to take up to 10 years to build.
Last Thursday, the Oregon legislation passed hundreds of bills under a $21 billion budget, with the most notable winners being a $5.3 billion transportation plan that will secure funding for road, bridge, and transit projects for the next decade. Lawmakers also passed mandates that women receive equal pay in comparison to men's pay, and also require insurers to cover reproductive services, including abortion, at no cost, and defer prison for some pregnant women. The legislature also passed Senate Bill 828, known as the Fair Workweek Act, which was shepherded through the Senate by a bipartisan team led by Senator Kathleen Taylor, a Democrat from Portland, and Senator Tim Knopp, a Republican from Bend. For blue-collar workers, new rules ensure that employees get proper overtime pay, and a first-in-the-nation law requires that low-wage workers receive schedules 2 weeks in advance and don't have to work back-to-back opening and closing shifts. The Fair Work Week Act also ensures that employees rest between shifts and receive extra pay if they're scheduled to work two shifts, with less than a 10-hour break in between.
Another bipartisan success in Oregon legislation is the move to extend Medicaid coverage to children brought illegally into the U.S. Although the bill was a priority policy for Democrats, a handful of Republicans voted yes on the bill. And last but not least, HB 2355, which partially decriminalizes heroin, methamphetamine, MDMA, cocaine, and some other drugs in small personal use, amounts for first-time offenders. Those qualifying first-time offenders will face no jail time. Instead, they will be eligible for probation in addition to small fines, with misdemeanor on their record instead of a felony. This is only half of HB 2355. It also provides expanded access to drug treatment resources and plans to reduce racial profiling through data collection and analysis. This means that instead of the black and white structure for detailing neighborhoods, categories will recognize Latino, mixed, and biracial backgrounds as their own valid races and ethnicities.
Now from our friends at Native Voice One, it's the National Native News with Antonia Gonzalez.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The chairman of the Crow Nation told reporters over the weekend that drug use on the reservation was a contributing factor to a shooting Friday, which left three people dead. Chairman Alvin Not Afraid Jr. told reporters the incident involved methamphetamines. It led the tribe to declare an emergency curfew for residents and those traveling on the Montana reservation from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. over the weekend. The investigation includes local and federal agencies. The Department of the Interior is revising a program which consolidates privately owned tribal land with multiple owners. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches has more.
The federal government allotted land to tribal members in the 1800s. The parcels have been inherited through generations, creating hundreds of owners, and much of the land remains unoccupied and unused. The voluntary land buyback program uses nearly $2 billion from a legal settlement to purchase the land allotments and turn ownership over to tribes. The Interior Department will expand the availability of mapping and appraisal information and assist with purchases. But the agency also says 20 tribes will now take part in the program, far fewer than planned under the Obama administration. Larry Rogers, director of the Eastern Navajo Land Commission, says the program benefits the tribe.
The Navajo Nation, as a government, gains more control of the land. Local communities have a lot more to say as how some of those lands can be used. better roads, more utility services, and perhaps greater chance for economic development.
More than 2 million acres of tribal land in the U.S. have been consolidated under the program since 2013, and members have collectively received $1.2 billion. The land buyback program ends in 2022. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff, Arizona.
Endangered species protections were lifted recently for grizzly bears in Yellowstone. Many tribes prepared for the delisting last fall by signing a treaty to protect the bears. But as Emily Schwing reports, one tribe in the Northwest looks at it differently.
Ray Entz is the director of Wildlife and Terrestrial Resources for Northeastern Washington's Kalispell Tribe. He calls delisting the Yellowstone grizzly a victory for the Endangered Species Act.
Getting a species identified as being at risk and then recovering it and having it move off of that list. That also frees up resources.
Those resources, according to Entz, could be used to help recover three other grizzly populations that live on traditional Kalispell land. Those are bears currently listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The Kalispels traditionally hunted them in winter, but haven't been able to in recent years. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
Native Americans were among more than 1,000 people ranging from age 50 to nearly 100 to compete in the recent New Mexico State Senior Olympic Games in Albuquerque. Archery, track and field, and bowling were among more than 20 sporting events. Valentino Candelaria from San Felipe Pueblo says the true reward of the games is health.
If you're in a good health, that's the most important thing and all that. But if you're not healthy, it really gets you down, because that's how I got started. I had 3 heart attacks, but now I'm back alive again, so I enjoy what I do and all that.
Sharon Birch Lenti says today making time for fun and sport as an elder is far different from how her Isleta Pueblo elders spent their day.
They were hard workers. They never took time to play. They worked from sun up to sundown. They didn't have that privilege. And we, in my generation now, we are so privileged to be allowed to play.
Many of the senior athletes will return to Albuquerque for the 2018 State Games with hopes to qualify for national competition in 2019. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork. Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Portland is looking for someone to oversee its $9 million Arts Administration office. The Regional Arts and Culture Council, or RACC, wields huge influence and provides grants that support everything from elementary school classrooms to old town galleries to high-end performance venues. Yet RACC is not a city office or bureau. Instead, it's a nonprofit. The outgoing director, Eloise Damrosch, says that RACC's unique status has allowed it unparalleled flexibility in setting up programs like the Right Brain Initiative and Work for Art program. However, Jeff Hawthorne, the director of community engagement, says that RACC's mission is broadly defined, which provides a lot of opportunities but can also cause unplanned long-term commitments. Several city officials, including Mayor Ted Wheeler, want to set priorities for the future and are asking for an audit of the program. We'll keep you posted as the story develops.
We're fortunate here in Portland to have such a vibrant community of live storytelling and radio theater. There's Willamette Radio Workshop, Portland Story Theater, Backfence PDX, The Mystery Box Show, Mortified, The Moth, just to name a few. One of the most intriguing members of this community is Tesla City Stories, who perform monthly at Portland's Fremont Theater. At a Tesla City Story Show, you'll experience an evening of live radio theater with scripts from the archives of the little-known Tesla Broadcasting Company, a radio network that operated for the short period between 1943 and 1945. These scripts include a wide variety of shows from the golden age of radio, sitcoms, mysteries, thrillers, westerns, even sci-fi. And they're performed live on stage, just as they were three quarters of a century ago, complete with music and sound effects. The new season of Tesla City Stories begins this Saturday, and here to talk about the premiere and Tesla City is the group's co-founder and producer, Jerry Chrisman. Jerry, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You've been here before.
We have. Yes, we have.
Now, as mentioned, Jerry, all the Tesla City shows are based on scripts from the old Tesla Broadcasting Company. Can you tell us a little bit about the TBC and how you and your producing partner, Brendan Jones, got a hold of these scripts?
Well, it's pretty fascinating. As you mentioned, my show partner and director of the show, Brendan Jones, he's a huge vintage radio fan and a really skilled researcher. And he, through a series of synchronistic events, stumbled upon these scripts, these old found scripts, and he found a whole box of them. And
is he allowed to reveal where he found them? Or were they in like a subway or underwater? Or
he knows he's the expert on all this. It's been a confluence. Some of them were sent to him, and a mysterious box showed up, and he was looking into them, and he found and kept researching and found that these stories have not been heard since the mid-40s. And he approached me about producing them to revive these stories. And the stories are very good and very much of their time, but it's little known. They're very obscure. The TBC only lasted a couple of years before it folded.
Yeah, so during the end, the ending years of World War II.
That's correct, yes.
But they were very much in the in that flavor of old-time radio.
And very much. As we mentioned. Very much in the genre. Very popular.
Now, you mentioned that Brendan's a big fan. Are you also of that golden age of radio?
Huge fan. I remember as a kid growing up and listening to old recordings. And then also, my father introduced me to old radio because he grew up in Kearns, Texas, and all they had was a radio. And the whole family would gather on Sunday evenings and listen to the radio. And
what was the show? Do you remember on Sunday evenings?
Oh, gosh. You know,
Jack Benny, Fred Allen.
It was all manner of the shows. And he just remembers, he was very little, but he just remembers he would stare at the vacuum tube glowing.
And with the lights out, huh? That's kind of a romantic image.
You'd go to sleep, but all the families came, his aunts and uncles and cousins, and they come and congregate. So it was a very communal experience. And that's and he introduced me to, my dad was very good about, and my parents were very good about introducing me to old media, you know, like when Snow White came out, my mom and dad said, we got to take you to the theater to see this. So that's where my love began for it.
And a lot of listeners, most of us probably haven't experienced it like your dad sitting around in that communal aspect. So what do you think is the attraction for those old time shows today?
I think one is being vintage. It's very strange to a lot of people because the radio then was the Netflix of its time. It was the internet.
Right.
And these years were, it was shortly before television really began to take off. So, I mean, that was it. It was newspapers and radio. And it was a very communal experience. And what we're recreating in our show is the live performance of it, is that people came and saw. A lot of people are confused now when we talk about, oh, come to our radio show, and they like, why would I come to your radio show? I'd listen to it on the radio, which is true. However, in the old days, golden age of radio, people came. There were live audiences, and it was very interactive. They have applause signs and all these cues in which we recreate in our show. So it was very, very fun for the audiences, and people listened live as well.
So people will not only get this kind of modern experience of going to a theater and seeing a great show, but they'll kind of relive those golden days, maybe pretending they're in the audience of Tesla Broadcasting Company in 1944 at one of these episodes.
That is correct. And also, I mean, theater is a small, you know, town square where people of all different backgrounds and stories can come together and, you know, differences melt away, and it's a communal experience. So that's why theater is important, especially with radio, radio theater. And you're tapping into history, and it also lets you look at today and appreciate how far we've come as a society. It's also just a lot of fun. We have a live sound effects artist, Foley artist, they're called. Very, very skilled Foley artist named David Ian, who's been doing it for a couple of decades now. And people just love the live sound effects.
And I've been to the shows. You have a cigarette girl.
We do have a cigarette girl.
A cigarette woman.
Yes. I checked with her. It was like, what do you want to be called? And she said, Cigarette Girl was
fine. They used to be called Cigarette Girls, yeah.
But she has treats. We sell candy cigarettes, which people seem to love. And we try to recreate the experience as much as we possibly can.
And you have a musical act, too, in between episodes.
We usually do. We have a variety of acts. One of our regular acts is Anna Paul and the Bearded Lady, who's amazing. She sings old vintage songs and standards and some originals. So the show is really a lot of variety. It's a cabaret style, so the audience interacts. You can get up and get a drink, get some food. It's a very, very relaxed, fun atmosphere, and there's a lot of audience feedback, talk back to us. And we have different segments that they all seem to love. One of our most popular segments is we pull people out of the audience to help us do Foley sound effects during a segment. And so it's a lot of fun.
And you have, I wanted to give you a chance to tell the listeners about the show this Saturday, what they can expect. And you're doing a sci-fi show, and you actually brought in one of the props.
Yes, here it is. All right, I don't want to blow anybody's ears out, but
okay. Oh, wow. That's a ray gun, by the way.
That is. Can't see it, but it is a working vintage 1944 ray gun, which will be a prize if you come to the show. And I've gotten so many calls on this ray gun. Everybody wants it. So,
And the show is a Questor of the Cosmos?
It is. I'll read the description here. It's okay. We'll bring you two episodes of the Tesla Broadcasting Company sci-fi anthology, Other Worlds, featuring the adventures of Questor of the Cosmos, straight from the golden age of radio, before the Guardians of the Galaxy, before Luke Skywalker, and slightly after Flash Gordon. There was Questor Galax.
Right. Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon, all those guys. So he's in that same vein.
Very much. It's high adventure, and we have robots and ray guns, and it's a lot of fun.
So really, the audience is transported back to that time, 1944. It's so realistic that you'll leave the theater, you'll think there'll be Nazis outside in Portland. wait, there are Nazis outside in Portland. I guess we haven't progressed that much. I should say, Jerry, where can KBOO listeners find out more about Tesla City, and if they like, buy tickets to Saturday's show, which could sell out. And in fact, almost all your shows have sold out.
Yeah, we sold out our entire first season. Every show does sell out. We have a few tickets left for this week, and I'm running a special for KBOO listeners. If you use the discount code KBOO, KBOO, at our website, TeslaCityStories.com, plural, TeslaCityStories.com, it'll take you there, enter the code, and you'll get 15% off your tickets. And we hope people come out and have a lot of fun in the summer with our summer blockbuster.
And again, it starts this Saturday.
This Saturday.
And it will be the first Saturday of every month, or the second Saturday of every month.
Usually they land in the middle of the month, but this one's this Saturday, August 12th, 8 p.m. at the beautiful Fremont Theater in Portland, Oregon.
Well, Jerry, thanks very much again for coming into KBOO today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
KBOO. So that's the discount code.
That is correct.
We've been talking with Jerry Chrisman, co-founder and producer of Tesla City Stories. The group starts their new season this Saturday, August 12th at Portland's Fremont Theater. That's 2393 Northeast Fremont. The show starts at 8 o'clock.
I don't know what these casting directors are looking for. You're my agent, Milt. You tell me. I mean, I got a dazzling smile.
Oh, sure, sure.
And I've got what Jack calls a couple of grade A gams.
Not bad at all.
And I got poise and grace and all that junk. And what's more, I can sing like a nightingale.
A wounded albatross, maybe.
Hey.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report about efforts to organize counter-demonstrations against a rally of nationalist right-wing extremists, which will be held this Saturday in Charlottesville, Virginia. At 6, it's Labor Radio, radio of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: Patchy smoke, but otherwise mostly clear, with a low around 64. Tomorrow, patchy smoke again. Mostly sunny, with a high near 91. Today in history. In 1964, Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. The only two senators to vote against the resolution were Alaska Democrat Ernest Groening and Oregon Democrat Wayne Morse. And in 1990, then-President George H.W. Bush ordered U.S. troops to be sent to Saudi Arabia as part of the buildup for the first Iraq War. The quote of the day is from the late Senator Wayne Morse, who said, "It is a truism that a democracy, so far as its enlightened action is concerned, can be no stronger than its educational system. When we are dealing with the schools of America, which should be dedicated to the development of the maximum extent possible of the intellectual potential of our own people, we are dealing with the greatest security weapon a democracy ever possesses."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The emotions were raw as pro-UAW Nissan workers lamented their union election loss here in Canton, Mississippi. But beneath the anguish created by Nissan's illegal fear and intimidation campaign triumph was a fierce determination by these workers to keep their eyes on the union prize. Antonio Hoover is a 13-year Nissan worker.
Many of us are on the verge of divorce. Many of us are on the verge of losing our families because of Nissan. But you put this doggone campaign and try to make us look bad. But you all are the one that did us like this. But I'm gonna tell you something, Steve Marshall. 6 months, baby. 6 months. If you don't clean this mess up, we will be back.
We'll be back.
We will be back.
We'll be back.
We will be back. We are the one that make the profit for Nissan. We are the one. UAW, strong, baby.
Nissan worker and UAW supporter Betty Jones.
We didn't do no dirty tricks. We didn't tell no lies. We did not intimidate anybody. We didn't. So we walk in that plant on Monday morning. You hold your head up. Because I'm going to walk in there because God gave me the courage. He gave me the boldness. Nissan ain't gave y'all nothing. When you walk in there on Monday morning, they're paying you for your labor. They don't care anything about you. We care about the people. We care about safety. We care about our benefits. And we still going to care about those things.
Right.
Let me tell you something. Our co-workers, they're going to find out how Nissan really is.
Yeah.
When they go in there Monday morning, cut your arrow.
Come on,
yeah. When you go in there Monday morning, they're going to turn that line speed up on you.
Right.
I want you to think about, thank Nissan then.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. They're going to show their true colors. They're going to show them. We're showing ours tonight.
The UAW has filed unfair labor practice charges against Nissan, and if Nissan is found guilty, there could be a repeat vote. Nissan worker Isaac Jackson.
A lot of times you don't get off the plantation in Mississippi on the first try.
All right.
Sometimes you have to wait till the midnight hour and slip off and leave your clothes and your shoes. But when you cross the Mason-Dixon line, y'all is free then. So don't you quit. Don't hold your head down. When you walk in that plant on Monday morning, lift your head high, hold your shoulders back, and let everybody know you've been in a good fight.
Amen.
And this is a good fight, and I'm glad I was in it.
Yeah.
I'm glad that I was in it. And guess what? It ain't over yet. It ain't over yet.
Reporting from Canton, Mississippi, Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now, from the Rick Smith Show and the Illinois Labor History Society, it's today's Labor History in 2 minutes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2 minutes. This day in labor history, the year was 1890. That was the day that one of the heroines of the U.S. labor movement, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, was born in Concord, New Hampshire. Elizabeth learned her progressive politics at a young age. Her father was a socialist and her mother a feminist. Elizabeth was kicked out of high school for speaking out in favor of socialism. This did not slow her down. She kept speaking and her reputation grew. She became a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. She traveled the country organizing and speaking to workers. From the Minnesota Iron Range to the textile mills of Lawrence, Massachusetts, Elizabeth was on the front lines of the labor struggle. She was arrested for her activity 10 times, but was never sentenced. During World War I, Flynn was arrested and stood trial for speaking out against the war. The experience led her to become one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization dedicated to protecting freedom of speech. In the 1930s, Flynn became a member of the U.S. Communist Party, writing a regular column for the Daily Worker. But despite her personal political ideas, she supported Democratic Party President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944. During the 1950s, she was caught up in the anti-communist hysteria led by Senator Joe McCarthy. She went to prison for 2 years for allegedly violating the Smith Act, a law against overthrowing the government. She died while on a visit to Russia in 1964. More than 20,000 people attended her funeral there. A monument to Flynn stands at the Forest Home Cemetery just outside of Chicago, where she is buried alongside the graves of Eugene Dennis, Big Bill Haywood, and the Haymarket Martyrs. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton is calling this weekend's mosque bombing a criminal act of terrorism. The attack occurred at the Dar el-Farouk Islamic Center in Minneapolis on Saturday. An explosive device was thrown through a window as members were arriving for prayer at 5 a.m. None of the approximately 20 occupants were injured, although portions of the building have been severely damaged. Congregation members stated they saw a truck leaving the parking lot at a high rate of speed afterwards, although there is no word yet on a connection and no arrests have yet been made. State police and the FBI are investigating the incident. The Minnesota chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations is urging Islamic centers to increase security in wake of the attack.
Two new nuclear power plants that had been under construction in South Carolina have been canceled due to cost overruns and numerous construction delays. The two nuclear power plants were only 40% constructed when the utility building the plants pulled the plug on the project. Originally expected to cost $11 billion to construct, the project had already spent $9 billion when it was halted. Regulators recently admitted the final cost could rise to more than $25 billion. The cancellation leaves only two other nuclear power plants under construction in the United States. Those plants, located in Georgia, are also under consideration for cancellation, after construction costs more than double to $25 billion. The Georgia Public Service Commission is scheduled to meet with energy company officials in the next few months to make a determination on whether to continue with the construction of those nuclear power plants. The cancellations are seen as a major blow to the future of nuclear power in the country. At its height, there were 250 nuclear power plants in the United States. That number is down to 99, and several of those are scheduled to be closed in the next few years. While the closure of the plants will stop the generation of nuclear power and the creation of new nuclear waste, the spent fuel rods will continue to cost power utilities and ratepayers for years.
The current U.S. president has increasingly turned to military officers to help run his administration. The White House now has four former generals running his administration and coordinating policies. They include John Kelly, a former U.S. Marine Corps general who was recently named White House Chief of Staff, H.R. McMaster, the current National Security Advisor, a former Lieutenant General in the U.S. Army, James Mattis, a former Marine Corps general and now the U.S. Secretary of Defense, and Joseph Dunford, the current Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and a former Marine General. All are known to be proponents of using military force to accomplish political goals. Not since the Eisenhower administration have military officers had such a strong influence on a presidential administration.
Scientists are now face-to-face with an explosive revolution of medicine. A technology capable of regrowing damaged organs and healing deadly serious wounds with a single touch has been created. This technology is known as tissue nanotransfection, or TNT. TNT is a dime-sized silicone chip that injects genetic code into skin cells. The point of this interaction is to turn skin cells into any type of cell necessary for medical treatment. The tissue nanotransfection technology has the potential to save millions of lives. However, it is alarming to question how TNT may be weaponized in the future.
A spokesman for the Pentagon has confirmed that U.S. Special Forces are operating in Lebanon, helping to coordinate a major offensive against troops with the so-called Islamic State. The IS forces are holed up in the mountainous region along the Lebanese-Syrian border. The Lebanese army, Hezbollah, and the Syrian army have already been conducting coordinated attacks on the ISIS positions. The presence of the U.S. military for training and special operations puts the U.S. in the position of allying with Hezbollah, an organization the U.S. has labeled as a terrorist entity. Iran's support of Hezbollah led the U.S. to label Iran as a prime sponsor of terrorism, and last week Congress signed new sanctions against Iran for their support of Hezbollah.
Australia's parliament today blocked efforts to have a legislative vote on whether to extend marriage rights to same-sex couples. Only seven Liberal Party members of Australia's ruling coalition government voted in favor of allowing lawmakers to vote on the issue. Instead, a bill is expected to be introduced later this session to allow for a vote of the people on the question. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull introduced legislation last October to allow for a non-binding public referendum on the issue, but that was blocked by the opposition Labour Party. Advocates regard a referendum as a delaying tactic because, as it would be non-binding, Parliament would then still have to pass legislation like legalizing same-sex marriage. In 2004, Australia passed a law defining marriage as only between a woman and a man. Since then, 20 bills have been introduced in Australia to legalize same-sex marriage.
Public Health England reports that there is now a global shortage of the hepatitis B vaccine. Claire Cook, a spokeswoman for PHE, states that more stock is on the way, but this has been an ongoing issue due to the difficulty in manufacturing the vaccine. For the time being, PHE is ensuring that those in the UK who are most at risk will receive top priority, to include infants with mothers who suffer from the infection and sexual partners of infected individuals. But those with a lower risk may have to wait a while, perhaps until 2018. People can reduce the risk of contracting the infection by avoiding unprotected sex, using only sterile equipment for injecting drugs, avoiding tattoos, piercings, and acupuncture while overseas, and by avoiding medical or dental care in high prevalence countries.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi is urging the North Korean government to comply with the United Nations after tough new sanctions were introduced. North Korea has received global pressure, condemning their threats of nuclear war against the U.S., and it appears that their biggest ally, China, is finally joining in. The continued nuclear tests and threats from Pyongyang were the major topics for discussion this week during Southeast Asia's annual meeting with the Philippines. Diplomats from all represented countries were quite vocal about North Korea's provocations. The U.S. president says that he is still willing to sit down and negotiate with North Korean leadership, but not until North Korea abandons its nuclear strategy.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced and driven newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories, tips, and commentary at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Isabel Cochran, Zion Bro, Sam Bowman, and Alicia Hypes. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zealous Ellis Marchant. Special thanks to Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Mahdi. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, on Alternative Radio, investigative journalist Chip Burlett discusses us versus them politics and how pitting one group against another has been used to mobilize resentment. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, DMA spotlights the Clackamas Repertory Theater's production of Irving Berlin's The Melody Lingers On. Then Randy Reinholtz's play Off the Rails makes the first time the Oregon Shakespeare Festival has produced a work from a Native American playwright. And at 11:30, Art Focus features the lively voices of artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Natalie. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to another KBOO News In Depth. We were going to hear from Emily Gorsinski, data scientist and activist, about the Unite the Right rally that is happening in Charlottesville, Virginia, this Saturday, but we will have to continue that tomorrow. Instead, we will be talking to a very special guest, KBOO News reporter Doug McFay, about some of the recent winners in the Oregon legislation, particularly involving the decriminalization of certain drugs. Yeah. So, Doug, do you count this as a win?
Sure. I mean, it is a partial decriminalization. That's important to make sure people know. I mean, really, decriminalization has never meant that you couldn't get busted for having something in possession. It never meant that it was legal. That's a different kind of word. Decriminalizing really just meant that you lowered the penalties, usually to the point where you weren't going to be taken to jail. You weren't going to be processed in the typical way. When California passed its decrim law back in 1975, the Moscone Act lowered the penalties for possession of under an ounce by an adult to a misdemeanor from a felony. As I said, de-emphasized the offense and de-escalated the sort of war on drugs that was going on. It didn't get rid of the criminal penalties. And in fact, well, arguably that was the problem with that word in the first place, because people didn't understand that when the officer wrote them out their citation and took away their pot, that they had been arrested. Those were, until 2010, California counted all of those in their reports to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, in their uniform crime reports, as an arrest. So in 2010, Arnie Schwarzenegger signed a bill to officially make a marijuana arrest not a criminal arrest, so it's no longer an arrest. An arrest isn't, when is an arrest not an arrest? So after that, there were no more of these marijuana possession arrests, which is why the 2011 arrest numbers showed a minor drop in the number of marijuana possession arrests. People were still getting stopped and having their pot taken away. It just didn't count as an arrest anymore.
So in that case, what we know so far, it's tying off of your definition of decriminalization, where there's methamphetamines, cocaine, heroin, and some other drugs. So when you say arrest, does that mean for first-time offenders, they won't be handcuffed and thrown in a paddy wagon or cop car?
That's tricky. But what it means is, essentially, that the penalty has been for simple possession of small amounts, personal use amounts of, as you said, heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, and ecstasy, or MDMA, is no longer going to be a felony. Rather, it will be a misdemeanor. Another thing in that bill provides for those people convicted of those offenses to be put into community corrections, that is to say probation, rather than going to jail. So it is going to make things easier for law enforcement. It's going to make things much easier in the criminal justice system generally. And, I mean, okay, during the final bit of debate on this, Josh Marquis from the, he's part of the Oregon District Attorney's Association's Clatsop County DA, a renowned drug warrior in this state, he was there representing only himself. but he's went there to speak against the bill. And as he said, it's not like they're actually, according to Josh, people don't really go to jail for that first offense, small personal possession of those drugs. So why are we bothering to change? I mean, well, I guess the question should have been turned around. Why on earth should we keep this horribly, you know, this incorrect classification? Why should we saddle people with a felony when the reality is they're not necessarily going to be given that harsh punishment? Because when you get down to it, the criminal justice system has to really prioritize victim crimes, violent offenses, acquisition offenses, robbery, theft. Those, I mean, there you have a legitimate victim. You have someone who's been aggrieved, who's been hurt, and they need justice. And, you know, when you're talking about someone whose only crime is that they got stopped on the street, and when they were emptying their pockets, a little bindle fell out. What reason does that person have to take up jail space? Why should we make room in the county correctional center for somebody whose only offense was being in possession and being clumsy? I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
I want to talk about the what I find to be the really important, another, well, I can't say the most important, but what I find to be the most interesting component of this bill is the data gathering aspect of it. And we've talked a lot in the newsroom about this quite a bit, and the double-edged sword of it, how statistically there's a very black and white categorizing when it comes to the criminal justice system in relation to drugs. So here they're offering or planning to implement a way to give way more categories for Hispanics, Latinos, a vast genre of brown people, mixed people, biracial people, finally getting validation as, you know, as the actual ethnicities that they are, instead of, well, you're white or you're black, which really erases the reality of a lot of people. And I think our audience would love to know where that data is going, how the powers that be plan to use that, whether it can actually be implemented for good.
Sure. The Criminal Justice Commission gathers data on law enforcement and criminal justice. You get reports from them every year, the Uniform Crime Report from the state of Oregon, and that data then goes to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where it's compiled into the National Uniform Crime Report. There's another crime report called Incident-Based Reporting, which we don't need to deal with. The main thing is that we gather the data so we know what we're doing, and we can make comparisons. The only reason we know that African Americans are overrepresented in the criminal justice system, are disproportionately arrested, is because you can look at the data that we've gathered and see these numbers. Especially true with drug offenses. It's much easier to figure out when it comes to drug offenses, because you can, you know, we know from the research, all the research, National Household Survey on Drug Abuse, which is now the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. I'll try not to do too much alphabet soup. I have been doing this work for a couple of decades, more than three decades. I'm getting so old. But, and so it can get, I might get into jargon. I apologize ahead of time. But we know from all this research that people basically use drugs at about the same rate. So if you have a situation where African Americans are being targeted and arrested at a higher, at a proportionally higher rate than whites, then you know something's going on. I've said before that law enforcement's really good at getting the usual suspects, but getting people actually committing crimes, that can be a little trickier. And like I say, with drugs, you know, you can actually find, you look at that, because as I say, they're roughly the same rates, so they should be getting arrested proportionally. Mm-hmm. But if they're not, then something's going on. It's when you get into other crimes that it gets tougher to really figure out the numbers. When you talk about other crimes, you have to understand that nationally, we don't find someone to pin the blame for property crimes. 4 out of 5 property crimes, we won't know who did it. The cops will not be able to pin the blame on someone. Those don't get, as it were, cleared. We clear an offense by arresting and indicting someone, bringing someone up on charges. So less than 20% of the property offenses nationally ever get cleared. Violent offenses, we barely do half. And remarkably, that's an improvement in the last 8 years. Basically, during the Obama administration, we did see some incremental improvement on those clearance rates. We're still doing badly, but that is an issue. And it's, again, it's tough because we don't know a lot of things about the rates people commit crime. But you can look at the numbers and think we may possibly simply be targeting the wrong people. So anyway, the data collection, like I say, we know some of this stuff because of the data. We know that in prisons, African-Americans are overrepresented, the same thing. One of the problems with data collection is the numbers that you're, what you're gathering. So I was looking into arrest statistics. Well, in fact, recently been doing research on marijuana arrests pre and post Measure 91, after it went into effect, to see what happened and to see that people do in fact still get arrested for simple possession for marijuana offenses, including possession, after the passage of Measure 91, after it went into effect. And these things are legal. Well, it's legal unless it's not. So I'm getting these numbers, and it's blacks, whites, Asian, American, you know, Native American, and that was it. I mean, you may have noticed there's a significant demographic group missing from that, and that's Latinos. According to the state, because I've been corresponding with the Criminal Justice Commission, according to the state, the reason is that, well, it's not required. You see, ethnicity, the Latin American ethnicity, it's not mandatory reporting. The National Criminal Information Center, which is maintained by the FBI, doesn't require states to report that, to collect that particular thing. If they don't have to, a lot of them don't. Some do, and along the system, other places will get ethnicity. So you'll find in the prison stats, we get that. But when it comes to arrests, it's all black and white. And I did ask my contact at the CJC, and according to the paper that she forwarded me, Latinos are simply, in this state, are simply called white for purposes of data reporting. Now, where that is a problem, I mean, okay, here are your numbers. Look, see, we're arresting all kinds of whites. Our numbers aren't that. We must not be racist, because look at all these. And it's like, well, that would be true, except that some of those so-called whites are actually Latin Americans. They're actually Latinos, Latinas. The idea being that if you just sort of tuck them into this category, makes your numbers look so much better, so much less racist. And I mean, this is a problem we've been facing for years now. I mean, 15 years ago, we were fighting to try and get ethnicity reporting made mandatory in the NIBRS system, National Incident-Based Reporting System, which is supposed to eventually replace the Uniform Crime Reports. They're still, in both those major data collections, their Latin American ethnicity is still optional. So, sure, if you want to, you can collect that information. But unless they make them, they're probably not going to. And they, like I say, in the case of this state, they haven't been.
Right. That leads to my next question of mandating the use of this data. Does that mean then that our state, or say Portland, would have to create a bill or legislation that would mandate that? How does that happen at the grassroots level?
It's thankfully, as far as I can tell from reading the bill, that's in there. There are various places along the way and various ways in which it's supposed to be analyzed and reported. And so ethnicity will now be, within the state, a mandatory report. I mean, they go by the federal standards, what's required and what's not, but we can impose that. So as far as I can see, they're going to have to now start indicating. And so we're going to see a change in our arrest statistics.
Will that affect too the data force reports? Well, or is that just going to be strictly you're throwing your hands up in the air? Yeah. Who knows?
Well, it's tough to say. And in fact, there are, I mean, in some jurisdictions, they may be collecting things like, Latino, the ethnicity, especially here in Portland, where we're maybe a little more sensitive than the state overall. Not maybe, what the heck? This is Portland. Of course, we're going to do a little more than the state requires. And it's for a good reason. Because again, when you can sweep those when you can sweep a group of people into this other category and basically bulk up the number of folks who you claim, that you say are white, then it's going to make a difference. You know, so when you stop doing that, it is going to make a difference. Yeah. I mean, we'll see as it unfolds.
But. Well, thank you so much for filling in for Emily today. I think that's incredible, the complexities of that bill. We didn't even get to, we'll have to save it for another day, going into being able to wash one record's clean of that.
May I
mention? Oh, wait, you got 2 cents.
Oh, could I put it? Well, may I do
it? We've got 2 cents to afford
just
you.
Just real quick plug, because we will be discussing HB 2355 on an upcoming episode of Prison Pipeline. It's probably another 3-4 weeks down the pike, but we will be talking about HB 2355 on an upcoming installment of Prison Pipeline.
Well, stay tuned, everybody. Thank you again, Doug.
Thanks.
Books and Records! Books and Records! Come on down to KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th, noon to 6 p.m. at Cider Riot. There will be fabulous books, DVDs, CDs, and vinyl at ridiculously low prices. It's a fun community event that benefits your favorite community radio station, KBOO. Again, that's KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th from noon to 6 at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne in Portland. Guerrillas of Desire argues that the left is wrong. The strategies are often based on the assumption that working and poor people are unorganized or simply uninterested in building a new world. Again, that's Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's Books, 3723 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.